Our next speaker is Dr. Charles Barrier. Dr. Barrier is an internal medicine physician. He has served in Ethiopia, Ghana, Peru, and most recently at Bingo Hospital, Baptist Hospital in Cameroon, through the World Medical Mission post-residency program. Charles is married to Angela, who is a pediatrician and is going to be speaking a bit later this morning. They have two sons, and he is going to be speaking to us on internal medicine in the tropics.
Well, good morning. I'm Chuck Barrier. I'm an internist, and I've had the chance to work a few different hospitals, but most recently in Cameroon at Bingo Baptist Hospital. And I want to use my time with you today to share some cases that we've taken care of on the medical wards there, some of them quite difficult, and what we've learned from those cases. So the objectives of my lecture today, to present some common cases that we've seen in the wards, like I mentioned, and discuss some diagnosis and management, share the role of internal medicine in providing subspecialty care in mission hospitals. We're always stretched beyond our formal training in the mission setting, and that's true at Bingo as well. And I want to discuss the role of physicians as educators in missions hospitals. We believe in that strongly at Bingo. You guys heard from Dave Thompson last night about that. And like I said, we enjoy doing that at Bingo, and we think it's important. We're going to move pretty quickly through the cases. Everything's in the syllabus, so if you miss something, you have it with you, so you can always refer back to it. So I'll skip this quickly. It was covered already. My experience, I've spent some time in Ethiopia and Ghana and Peru, but most recently was in Cameroon with the post-residency program. I was there from 2012 to 2014 with my wife and two sons. And we continue to go back there 2 months a year and stay involved with the hospital. So this is a picture of the front of Bingo Baptist Hospital. It's actually different now. They're building a lot. So it's a 300-bed hospital in the northwest region of Cameroon. And like I said, there's multiple teaching programs there. The one that I'm involved with mostly is the SIMS program, the Christian Internal Medicine Specialization Program. It's a four-year internal medicine residency program, and it's for African doctors. Previously, I would have said it was only for Cameroonian doctors, but we took our first Sierra Leone resident this year, so we've expanded beyond Cameroon. Inside of that program, they do 25% pediatrics. Wherever they go as an internist, there's not going to be a pediatrician, and so putting some pediatrics in that as well allows them to serve in their new hospital after they finish training with us. There's also a PACS program there, which you've heard some about already. We work with them. A nurse practitioner program that we do, and then there's even a nurse anesthetist program, and there's multiple other training things that are going on at the hospital. So that's the culture there. This is a picture that I took about a year ago of some of the current residents that we have, and all of these doctors are Cameroonian, some of them starting to finish up, but we're really proud of what they accomplished during 4 years, and we hope that they learn a lot of medicine during 4 years, that they become better physicians, but we also hope that they grow in their walk with the Lord. And during their time with us, that they learn, they grow in their faith, and then they're going to go to a new hospital. And when they get there, they will immediately become one of the senior faculty. People are going to be looking to them, both medically and hopefully spiritually as well. And we hope that changes the culture of many hospitals in the future. This is our morning report room. We have a morning lecture each day. Afternoon conferences, and so that gives you a kind of a taste of what it looks like there. We have a patch that goes on the coat, so I set up this lecture like I'm going to take you on morning rounds. So we're going to see some patients on the ward. This is me rounding with some of our residents and house officers and nurse practitioner students. So our first patient is in bed B8 on the men's ward. He's a 36-year-old man. He just got admitted. He has a history of fever, headache, and altered mental status. He's also had a non-productive cough for a few weeks. He's lost weight. We don't know his HIV status. He's very sick. His temperature is elevated, 38.6. He's tachycardic. And fortunately, his respiratory status is okay. He looks thin. He's got oral thrush. His mucous membranes are dry. He's tachycardic. And skip down to the neuro. He's alert to person only. His eyes do open spontaneously. He can move all his extremities, but he doesn't really do it on command. He just does it at times. So our plan, we want to get some labs, a chest x-ray, urinalysis, HIV test, and a lumbar puncture. I should add an RDT or a malaria test on there as well. So the initial results come back, CBC, fairly normal for us. Kent already talked about, you know, lower hemoglobins. Unfortunately, we see those, and that doesn't necessarily mean that there's an acute process. You see the hemoglobin's 8.1. These are kind of common numbers for a patient that we see. The BNP, we do have a machine that can run those labs, and fairly normal. LFT's normal, urinalysis normal, chest x-ray normal. Like I said, RDT, or malaria test, also negative, so it doesn't have malaria. So the next test, HIV is positive, as many of you guys probably expected, and lumbar puncture shows an opening pressure of 29, which is a normal is 10 to 20, so it's elevated opening pressure, so increased pressure of the CSF. White blood cell count is 10, red blood cell count 0, India ink positive, which is a stain looking for cryptococcus in the CSF, and then the cryptococcal antigen was also positive. So the diagnosis of cryptococcal meningitis is made, and we see this commonly in our wards. So there's an estimated 1 million cases a year, with 75% of those in sub-Saharan Africa. And this disease has 100% mortality if untreated. And it's usually seen in HIV-positive patients, usually with low CD4s, usually less than 100. Symptoms similar to what our patient had. And we should have a high degree of suspicion in our HIV patients with low CD4s with any of these symptoms. So diagnosis is made by lumbar puncture, just like our patient. You'll see an elevated opening pressure usually. Many of you guys do LPs, maybe been a while, but you get a kit in the United States and it has a glass manometer. It's really convenient and fancy. We don't have that there, of course. But if you want to measure opening pressure in Africa with limited resources, lay the patient on their side, use the needle to get into the CSF, and use regular IV tubing. Hook it up to the needle, hold it up vertically, and see how high the column of CSF travels, and then measure that. And that's centimeters. That's your opening pressure in centimeters of water. So it's often elevated, even above 25 in cryptococcal meningitis. Usually the white blood cell count is not that high, less than 50, even less than 5, normal. And then the India ink has a 70% sensitivity, which means you're going to miss 3 out of 10. In some diseases, that might be okay, but in cryptococcal meningitis, that's a problem when it's 100% mortality if you don't treat it. Cryptococcal antigen gets us much higher, greater than 95% sensitivity. So at Bingo, we've started using the cryptococcal antigen lateral flow assay. This is a new thing over the last few years. We're able to get this from the U.S. I'll show you a package. It's easy to use. It's like a urine dipstick. It doesn't need refrigeration. It's just stored in a little bottle. You dip it in the CSF, and it tells you the answer. And our lab techs do it very well. And it compares well in studies with more complicated methods. This is the bag that it comes in. It has a few little plastic containers. And this is the dipstick sitting in a CSF. It's simple. So imaging. What is the formal recommendation for imaging these patients? Well, in the U.S., you would get a CT of the head before you did a lumbar puncture. They're an HIV patient who's immunosuppressed. Maybe they have focal neurologic signs. Maybe they don't. But it's unlikely that most of the hospitals that you guys will work at will have a CT scanner. Maybe a couple, but very few will. And so you're going to have to make a decision on whether that's something you want to do for these patients or not. So at Bingo, and I'm going to talk a little bit about how we do things at Bingo during this lecture, but at Bingo, we've come to the conclusion that the benefits or the information that we can gain from an HIV-positive patient with infectious symptoms outweighs the risks of herniation from the LP. So we do proceed, like we did with our patient. So let's get to treatment. So in the United States, the standard treatment, I'm going to mention that first so then I can tell you how we do things a little differently. It's a three-phase treatment in the United States, with induction being the first 2 weeks. It's intensive with amphotericin B. It's a liposomal form in the U.S., with fluocytosine. After that 2 weeks, you do a consolidation phase for 8 weeks, which with fairly high dose fluconazole for those 8 weeks. And then there's a maintenance phase that lasts for a whole year where you take a kind of a normal dose of fluconazole, 200 a day for the rest of the year. And the hope is that with antiretrovirals that your CD4 has climbed at the end of that year as well. This is what's done in the United States. We'd love to do that at Bingo, but there's some issues. First of all, amphotericin B is difficult to obtain. When we first got to Bingo a few years ago, we didn't have amphotericin B, but in the last few years, we've been able to obtain it. And so now we have amphotericin B, but we don't have the liposomal form. We have the old regular form, which is the deoxycholate. That does have some side effects that we have to deal with, and we'll talk about that, but we do have amphotericin B now. Fluocytosine can't get it. And then fluconazole can be expensive, especially when you're giving it high doses for up to a year. Each pill, a family may be able to afford a week's worth supply, but thinking about affording a year's supply is really out of reach. We used to get this brought in from South Africa through a grant. So we're able to give it free. And then more recently, the Cameroonian government has stepped up and started providing that to our patients. So that's a big part of our treatment. And that's the amphotericin B that we've been able to obtain. So a couple comments on the induction phase as we think about the difference. 1 week of amphotericin B. So this is in a study, and there's a reference in your syllabus. In a resource-limited setting, it was a small study, but 1 week of amphotericin B with 2 weeks of high-dose fluconazole may be the best combination when they looked at cost and side effects. That gave us a little bit of made us feel a little bit better when sometimes we couldn't do the full 2 weeks, and we'll get to that. High-dose fluconazole is also in your syllabus. High-dose fluconazole is equivalent to flucytosine. So we're okay with not having flucytosine and using high-dose fluconazole instead with the amphotericin. But having amphotericin B is a big deal because it's fungicidal compared to the fungostatic properties of fluconazole. So what do we do at Bingo? The induction phase, the first 2 weeks. We use regular amphotericin B. You guys, the dosing's in your syllabus. And then we consider using it the second week. We'd like to, but things come up like hypokalemia, kidney injury, sometimes rigor, sometimes drug fever has even limited our ability to give it the full 2 weeks. But we feel okay if we can at least get that first week in. And then alongside the amphotericin B, we give 1,200 of fluconazole daily for 2 weeks. Now that goes the full 2 weeks, whether the amphotericin makes it or not. Then we do consolidation very similar to the U.S. Maintenance is similar to the U.S. And I just put in here that if the patient is not on antiretroviral therapy and you start treatment for cryptococcal meningitis, you should wait 4 weeks before you start the antiretroviral therapy, before you initiate it. When you mix the amphotericin B from powder to solution, it has to be covered because light is damaging to it. So that's one of our towels over a bag as it's going into a patient. Biggest risk, I've already mentioned, with the amphotericin B, and even more true for the regular amphotericin B that we use, renal injury. We do give aggressive IV fluids. We like to give 500 cc's before and after each dose. That's a little difficult with our nursing. And so what we've come to is doing 1 liter 3 times a day and kind of keeping the patient very well hydrated throughout the course of amphotericin. We monitor the creatinine closely. If we see a rise, we hold the amphotericin, and we see if it'll come back down, and we'd like to get that at least 7 days in. And so we will restart it if we can. And hypokalemia, even we were just there a few weeks ago, and hypokalemia can limit our ability to continue amphotericin B on one patient. So lumbar punctures, therapeutic lumbar punctures, I should say. Let's talk about that. So cryptococcal meningitis has elevated pressure. You can lower that pressure by doing repeat lumbar punctures, and we consider doing that about every 48 hours. We do it for worsening headache, worsening mental status. Some places would even do it to lower pressure to a certain level. We remove about 20 cc's of CSF each time. Some patients need this frequently, every 48 hours for a week or two. Some patients never need it again after their diagnostic. And there's even some evidence that there may be a mortality benefit to this, but that was also a small study, so I don't want to overstate that, but it does help symptomatically for sure. So what was the conclusion of our case? So we treated this patient with amphotericin B and fluconazole initially. We got 10 days of amphotericin B in, but this patient was limited by hypokalemia. We could not get the potassium even above 3 with the amphotericin B in the second week. So we had to hold the amphotericin B and fix the potassium. We felt okay not giving the last 4 days of amphotericin. We continued the fluconazole for the rest of the induction phase. Skip the third line there. He was then he goes to consolidation phase like normal, 400 milligrams for 8 weeks. Then he will take fluconazole 200 for the rest of the year. We waited 4 weeks to start our antiretrovirals. He had a CD4 of 45 on admission, and we hope that, you know, with taking that well over the course of the year, it should easily get above 100. But he'll be followed through our HIV clinic. Okay. Let's move to the next case. So this is going to the female ward. You can see in the picture here one doctor is kind of looking at a patient. That's Ernest. He's one of our second year residents. He's excellent. David Sunday has back to you. He's at the counter with the patient's charts. He's one of our first year residents, just started. There's some nurse practitioners in the distance. They're getting ready. They're pre-rounding. So we're going to go see a patient in F18. She's a 38-year-old female. She was admitted with worsening edema, altered mental status, and poor urine output. She was treated at a different health center nearby for malaria, and they did a good job treating her. She had a rapid diagnostic test, which is a very accurate test for malaria, both sensitive and specific, and it was positive. And then she received quinine for 2 days. She was very sick, and then she got converted to Coartem, which is an oral malaria medicine. It's an artisan-based dual therapy. It's used commonly in Africa, and it works very well. So she got that for 3 days to complete her treatment. She did get a blood transfusion and some IV fluids at the health center. Her fever resolved. Her mental status improved. She went home, and she was feeling better. She was cured of malaria and was doing better. But then she started to notice she wasn't making much urine, and she started to have swelling. That's when she came to Bingo Baptist Hospital. So on her exam, she's afebrile. She's pulse is normal. She's a little hypertensive, a respiratory a little increase, and she's in some mild respiratory distress. Her mucous membranes are moist. Her heart exam was normal. She had some crackles at her bases. Her abdomen was soft, non-distended, and she had 3+ lower extremity edema. Her labs, again, we have a BMP. Sodium is a little low. Potassium 6.2 elevated. You also note that CO2 or bicarb, chest of acidosis, is low, so she's acidotic. Her BUN was very elevated at 190, creatinine 15, so she's in renal failure. And that fits with her exam and her history as well. Her LFTs are normal, and urinalysis, she has no urine output, so we can't get one. So at that point, we made the diagnosis of acute tubular necrosis from malaria. And the plan is to start acute peritoneal dialysis. And the surgeons are going to place a PD catheter, and then we're going to start doing fluid exchanges and treating her with peritoneal dialysis. So talk about acute tubular necrosis first. It can be aneuric, oliguric, or non-oliguric. So you can have no urine, small amount of urine, or normal amount of urine and still have ATN. Some of you guys take care of patients with ATN. A common reason people get it is hypovolemia. Then they get a pre-renal injury that worsens, and then they get ATN. And that happens in malaria too. But malaria also has a couple other hits that can cause it. One is pigment nephropathy, and one is a microvascular injury. ATN, fortunately, is usually reversible. Not always, but usually reversible, and usually reverses in 1 to 3 weeks, sometimes quicker, sometimes longer. But during that time, their glomerular filtration rate, their kidney function, may be very low, and they may deal with all the effects of somebody who has non-functioning kidneys. So treatment involves managing those issues that come with that, and sometimes those can be managed without dialysis, of course, but then sometimes we've been able to do dialysis at Bingo. This is a picture of malaria pigment in a monocyte that our pathologist showed me, and I thought I'd share it with you because he said it was really rare to see it. So, the actual pigment in the monocyte. So ATN management, treat the underlying problem, stop any ongoing kidney injury, avoid nephrotoxins. You can manage some of the issues, let's talk about those. Volume overload. They're not making much urine, they're volume overloaded. Sometimes you can use very high dose Lasix to get them to make enough urine to keep their volume status under enough control to give them enough time that maybe their kidneys will recover. So you may use a dose as big as 200 milligrams of IV Lasix every 6 hours. And that's worked occasionally, but our experience has not worked as well as we would often hope it would, and the patients have remained volume overloaded. Hyperkalemia, another big problem. K-oxalate can remove potassium from the body. We can get that most of the time. You can shift potassium other ways, but if the kidneys aren't going to improve, you know, you buy yourself a little time, but maybe not enough time for the ATN to resolve. Acidosis, that one's difficult. Bicarb can be given, but little to no benefit there. And uremia, if they're symptomatic from uremia, there's not much we can do other than remove the urea. So peritoneal dialysis, some of y'all are probably surprised that we're doing that at a mission hospital, and we were 2-3 years ago. 3 years ago, a group came to us and offered to help us set up peritoneal dialysis, provide all the supplies for 2 years to get it started. We were skeptical. We started slowly, and it worked actually very well. And there's a few hospitals on the continent that are doing it in situations like ours, in missions hospitals like ours. So we do short course. This is not a chronic peritoneal dialysis. This is to buy some time for the kidneys to recover from an acute injury. And we can do up to a month. So they initially had supplies like catheters, drain fill setups, other supplies, fluid. The fluid comes in multiple concentrations of glucose, 1.5, 2.5, and 4.25. So we had a whole room full of fluid. It looked great. But, you know, that fluid only lasts so long. How peritoneal dialysis works, very briefly. Fluid is put into the abdomen, and the capillaries in the peritoneum function to remove things from the body, either fluid, potassium, urea. Creatinine does move too, acid, some things move from those capillaries in the peritoneum into the fluid we put in the abdomen. We take that fluid out and throw it away and put fresh fluid in and do the whole process again. So that's the peritoneal membrane. The osmotic gradient speaks to the water flowing. The glucose in the dialysis fluid provides an osmotic pull for water. So the higher glucose concentration, more water is going to come in. Diffusion gradient speaks to a lot of urea in the body, no urea in the dialysis fluid. It's going to move that way. High potassium in the body, low potassium in the fluid. It's going to move that way into the fluid. Then we're going to dump it and do it again. This is our first patient with peritoneal dialysis. First setup. Our nurses that we trained, we prepared, we got ready, and they did an excellent job. You can see the nice, pretty bag of dialysis fluid there. I think it was from a company in the United States, and it went very well, and that patient recovered. It was a child. But like I alluded to, we ran out of fluid. And so we said, what are we going to do? Are we going to stop doing peritoneal dialysis? And that was one option. Buying fluid and shipping it from the U.S. was not going to be an option. There was no way we were ever going to be able to afford that. So we said, well, what if we made our own fluid? Could that be an option? Dennis Palmer is an internist at Bingo, and he also has some pharmacy background, and we started to think about what our options could be, and we actually went to some old books and looked through some things and looked at the makeup of the fluid, and we decided sterile lactated ringers with some D50 added is a pretty close substitute, and so we decided to try that. Our lactated ringers comes in 500 cc's, and we mix it with some amount of D50 to get the percentage of glucose that we want. How much osmotic pull do we want? Does this patient have a lot of water that we want to pull out, or a little bit of water? And so we decide. We can dial it in. And this tells you kind of the most common to get a 2.5% solution. It's a similar makeup to PD fluid, but it must be kept sterile. That is critically important. This is our supplies, or some of our supplies. You see IV tubing there on the left. You see a scale that allows us to measure how much fluid goes in, how much fluid comes out, and we obviously chart that very carefully. Sterile towel there, a bag of 500 cc's of LR, and a bag of D50. This is a peritoneal catheter and a lady's abdomen. So how do we do PD? First of all, we want to identify the patient. We want to find patients that have reversible injuries. Are we going to be wrong sometimes? Sure. But we want to find those people that have reversible injuries that over the course of a month or even shorter could have recovery of their kidneys. Sometimes size of kidneys on an ultrasound can help. If they're small kidneys, that may imply that they're scarred and it's been more of a chronic process. And is there a mechanism of injury? I mean, our patient just recently had malaria. I just told you that malaria causes ATN. This patient, and they immediately developed new symptoms. So we have a reason to believe our patient had an acute injury. We have our surgeons place the PD catheters. They can speak more to that. What I know is that it has to be well placed with the cuff and the rectus sheath. If it's not placed well, it'll leak. And if it leaks, it has to be replaced. There's really no other way around that. And you need well-trained nurses. We train them at Bingo ourselves, and they do an excellent job. Sterile technique is very important. So when you're writing the orders, you choose how much glucose you want in the fluid. How much water do you want to pull? High glucose, more water pulling. Low glucose, less water pulling. So you choose that. And then you choose the volume. Well, it's almost always 2 liters. You may start with 1 liter first to stretch the abdomen a little bit, but then go to 2 liters. And then the dose for kids is there, the same. Work your way up to that. We typically leave the fluid in for 4 hours. We can use a shorter time if the patient is very sick and we want to expose them to that early gradient for more time. We will change the fluid every 2 or 3 hours. But I'll say most commonly we do 4 hours. Maybe the patient's doing very well and is very stable, and you want to not wake them up at 3 in the morning. You might do a longer dwell through the night. And if you were treating peritonitis, you would leave the fluid in a little longer too. Inflow-outflow times is basically as fast as it'll go in and out, usually 15 to 30 minutes. And we just do this process 24 hours a day, just until we decide they don't need dialysis anymore. So what are the complications? I mentioned leaking catheters. There are obstructed catheters. Sometimes omentum can flap over, and then the fluid doesn't drain well. Sometimes that can be fixed non-surgically, but sometimes it requires a little movement of the catheter. Peritonitis, you can imagine, I'm talking about putting a huge amount of glucose into the abdomen, and bacteria obviously are going to love sugar. So a small amount of bacteria are going to propagate, and that can become a problem. Fortunately, peritonitis in peritoneal dialysis patients is fairly easy to treat. And we're able to use antibiotics and put them directly into the PD fluid and put those antibiotics into the abdomen. We can also use IV antibiotics as well. And as you'd expect, gram positives from the skin are a big problem, but you have to cover gram negatives as well. I skipped over a little bit there. It's a white blood cell count greater than 100. And we don't just order these all the time. We look for symptoms. Abdominal pain, fevers, or cloudy fluid is often the first sign. So when do we stop PD? Well, when you have clear evidence of renal recovery. If the kidneys are getting better, we'll stop it. often increasing the urine output is the first sign. We follow labs every day while they're on peritoneal dialysis. And just to note that sometimes the urine output increases before the actual filtration improves. So we see the urine output increase, we're happy, but we still want to keep the peritoneal dialysis going until we really see a change in the labs. So what's the conclusion of our case? So our patient received peritoneal dialysis with exchanges every 4 hours around the clock, and her volume status improved. Over the course of the first 4 days, her creatinine improved from 15 to 9, but then it kind of held there. But her urine output actually got to normal, and it kind of entered that phase that I just talked about. But it was another 3 days of normal urine output and dialysis before we saw the creatinine actually start to go down again from 9. And at that point, we really knew things were going to get better. She got 8 days of peritoneal dialysis before it was stopped, the catheter was removed, and then she went home. Creatinine was 3, she had good urine output, normal exam, and a follow-up appointment. Will her creatinine normalize? I don't know, but it'll keep getting better, at least for a period of time, and we'll see how good it can get. But we were very happy with how she did. All right, next case. So we're going to go to the ICU now. This is a new ICU at Bingo. It's been open now for just months. And you see Albert there, one of our third-year resident in the foreground, and he's pre-rounding in the ICU. He's seeing some of the patients before I come and meet him. So ICU bed 3. So it's a 23-year-old female. She's admitted to the ICU with severe respiratory distress. She's been getting worse over the past 4 days. She has dyspnea and exertion, abdominal distension, lower extremity edema, and orthopnea. And now she has dyspnea at rest. I mean, these are heart failure symptoms. And that's what she looks like. She had a normal pregnancy and delivered a healthy baby boy 1 month ago, and no complications there. On exam, she's afebrile, she's tachycardic, her blood pressure is a little low, and she's breathing very fast, and she's hypoxic. On exam, she's in severe respiratory distress. Her mucous membranes are moist, she's tachycardic, she has an S3, she has JVD to the angle of her jaw, she has diffuse crackles, her abdomen's distended, she's got 3+ lower extremity edema. So an exam that's consistent with heart failure as well. Labs, her CBC is normal. Her basic metabolic panel, notable for a small kidney injury, creatinine of 2.2, elevated BUN. Her LFTs show a slight elevation in her AST and ALT. Her chest x-ray, cardiomegaly, diffuse alveolar infiltrates, pulmonary edema, small bilateral pleural effusions, what you'd expect from your exam, really. And EKG shows sinus tachycardia. So at Bingo, we have ultrasound, but thanks to some radiologists and some cardiologists that have come out, we've even gone to be able to do echo, and the technicians do it very well. And so our echo there showed an EF of 20%, and all the chambers were dilated. She has pulmonary artery systolic pressure of 65, and she has severe tricuspid regurgitation. So we made the diagnosis then of peripartum cardiomyopathy. So let's talk about that for a second. So the definition of peripartum cardiomyopathy is development of heart failure towards the end of pregnancy or in the months following delivery. It's a little bit vague, but that's the definition. Left ventricular ejection fraction needs to be less than 45%, so they have true systolic heart failure, and they have no other identifiable causes of heart failure. This is rare in the U.S. 1 in 4,000 live births is the quoted number, but much more common in West Africa, as areas are as high as 1 in 100. Now, we don't see it at that rate at Bingo, but we do see it much more commonly than I've ever seen it in the United States. Etiology, really unknown. So differential. Well, pregnant women get heart failure for other reasons, too. It's not just peripartum cardiomyopathy. So we have myocarditis. Maybe they had a congenital heart defect that was mild and is presenting in pregnancy. A valvular heart disease, same similar situation. Maybe they had eclampsia with blood pressure so high that they have some heart failure. Maybe they have a pre-existing cardiomyopathy that's presenting in pregnancy. So presentation, like our patients, similar to other forms of heart failure. At Bingo, unfortunately, we see these patients typically the first time on our wards very sick, volume overloaded, sometimes in cardiogenic shock, hypotensive. They can present with milder forms in the heart failure in clinic. We just don't get to see them there very often. So echo is the diagnostic test of choice. It's available at Bingo, like I mentioned. Many of your hospitals will have ultrasound, and many of them may do echoes as well, and it's incredibly useful. And we're thankful to the doctors that have been able to come out and train our technicians to do such a good job. You can make a diagnosis without echo, but it won't be as accurate. And you can do a chest x-ray if you need to confirm pulmonary edema, but make sure you shield the baby if they're antepartum. to treatment. You have to support them with oxygen. How much oxygen they need, well, it'll depend on the patient. Nasal cannula, face mask, non-invasive ventilation. That's been difficult for us, the non-invasive things like BiPAP. We've tried to implement that some at Bingo, but it's been a challenge. We did just open the ICU at Bingo, and the ICU, we see it, at least for medical patients, it's best used for people that have a reversible problem, and peripartum cardiomyopathy patients are perfect examples of this. So what medications do we use to treat these patients? So beta blockers. You guys know beta blockers and heart failure. There's a mortality benefit in systolic heart failure with beta blockers. We start these after the patient's decompensation is resolved. We've diuresed them some, and their volume status is better. Metoprolol is preferred, and you can use it antepartum or postpartum, but we don't have metoprolol, and other hospitals I've worked at didn't have metoprolol, but we do have atenolol. So what do we do with atenolol? Well, atenolol, there's some concerns for growth restriction in the antepartum period, so we don't use it antepartum, but we do use it postpartum. Some people might use the antepartum, but that is the concern. Diuretics, we use them for volume control, typically Lasix. Digoxin, you can use it safe. It's safe antepartum and postpartum, but there's no mortality benefit. But it may be very important to control symptoms in these patients, especially in the antepartum period where medicines are more limited. ACEs or ARBs, most hospitals have seen a lot of captopril. We have lisinopril now. Can't use it antepartum, but can use it postpartum, and there's a mortality benefit, so we recommend that postpartum. Hydralazine and nitrate, we don't have this at Bingo. We do have an IV form of hydralazine, but if you have that orally, you can think about that as a alternative to your ACE or ARB in the antepartum period when you can't use the ACE or the ARB, and then switch it after the baby is born. Aldosterone antagonist, spironolactone, you can't use it antepartum. It's probably safe postpartum. There is a mortality benefit using this in advanced systolic heart failure, but we're very cautious with this medicine at Bingo because you need good lab follow-up, and using it with an ACE and an ARB increases the risk of hyperkalemia, so we really limit its use. We don't use it very often. So anticoagulation. Should patients with peripartum cardiomyopathy be anticoagulated? Well, we know they're at increased risk of a left ventricular thrombus. Their left ventricle is not pumping well, and they can develop a clot there. But at the same time, there's no clear evidence that supports using anticoagulation in these patients, even when their ejection fraction is low. But there might be some reasons that we would want to use Lovenox and warfarin. And we do have Lovenox and warfarin at Bingo. Lovenox is expensive, but we can use it, and warfarin has its own challenges, which I'll mention, but if the patient has a known thrombus, if you see the thrombus on echo, we think that the benefit of giving anticoagulation is there, and it outweighs the risks. If you're in the United States, most of these patients, if they developed atrial fibrillation, and a lot of them have a dilated left atrium, so they're at increased risk of atrial fibrillation, a lot of those people would get anticoagulation in the United States, and I mentioned they're going to score on these scoring systems that help us determine their risk of having an embolic stroke from atrial fibrillation. By definition of their disease, they're going to reach a level where anticoagulation is reasonable. But we'll get to what we do at Bingo. So like I said, we do use it if initial intracardiac thrombus is seen, we give anticoagulation. Lovenox alone if they're antepartum, and there's cost issues with that. But we don't see as many, we see much more postpartum cases than antepartum cases. Lovenox bridge to warfarin if they're postpartum. But we don't use Lovenox or warfarin for atrial fibrillation in these cases, no matter the CHADS or the CHADS VASC, no matter these scoring systems. We just don't feel like the benefit is greater than the risk in our setting. INR testing is expensive. The patients need to follow up. There's cost involved. And the quality of our testing. So we do not anticoagulate those people. And as a general rule at Bingo, we use anticoagulation when we know there's a clot, a new DVT or cardiac thrombus, but we don't use it for things like atrial fibrillation as a preventive measure because of the risk-benefit ratio. We probably would give them low-dose aspirin for atrial fibrillation if they were postpartum, if they had atrial fibrillation. So what's the prognosis? Many patients will have recovery of their ejection fraction. 20 to 60% of patients will recover, and usually that's in the first 6 months, but it can happen later. But some patients don't recover, and some patients even have a worsening of their heart failure. There's increased risk with future pregnancies. The symptoms could return or even be worse. What do we recommend to people? Well, the risk is related to how low the ejection fraction gets and how much recovery is seen. So if the nadir is less than 25%, then they probably shouldn't get pregnant again. if their recovery is less than 50%, they probably shouldn't get pregnant again. So bingo, like I mentioned, we usually see these patients very sick, and they're usually postpartum. So what do? We diurese them, and we start lisinopril. We add atenolol once their volume status improves, and we try to titrate up those medicines as an outpatient. If they had atrial fibrillation, we'd give low-dose aspirin, but not further anticoagulation. And if they had an intracardiac thrombus, we'd use Lovenox and warfarin. For the rare patient that we may see antepartum, a little different, we would give diuresis, but we would need to use digoxin earlier because of our limited other treatment options. We can't use lisinopril. We don't have the hydralazine and nitrate, which I mentioned. And we wouldn't give aspirin in the antepartum period. And we do try to use Lovenox alone, antepartum, and then transition to warfarin after the child was born. Future pregnancies, I already mentioned this. We follow what I already recommended. And if the patient has an ejection fraction less than 25% or they don't recover above to at least 50%, we would recommend that they not get pregnant again. And we send them to our OBGYN clinic to talk about what options for birth control. So, case conclusion, she was admitted to the ICU, given oxygen. We gave her Lasix, 80 milligrams twice a day, IV. She responded well. She had good diuresis. Her respiratory status improved. Her repeat labs showed her creatinine improved from 2.2 to 1.2. We were able to start lisinopril at that point. We ultimately took 8 kilograms off of her, and she went home with compensated systolic heart failure with an ejection fraction of 20%, if you remember. So she was starting on atenolol at discharge, and we wanted to titrate that up as an outpatient. She didn't have a thrombus and didn't have atrial fibrillation, so we didn't have to worry about anticoagulation for her. And then we referred her to our OBGYN clinic because of how low her ejection fraction got to recommend that she not get pregnant again. And that's a difficult thing in Cameroon and other areas of Africa, but you know that is the right thing. We think that's the right thing to recommend, at least discuss with the patient. Okay, so that's the end of that case. In the last just a few minutes, I want to mention a few other pearls from Bingo, very short things that I didn't want to give up this chance to mention to you guys, things that I've learned and seen and the things that we do at Bingo, and maybe this will inspire some of you guys. Maybe you're a subspecialist and looking for a place to serve or an internist or wherever God's called you to serve. Maybe you see, well, Bingo or a hospital like that may be a place that I could work. So TB pericarditis. We see quite a few of large pericardial effusions in HIV-positive patients. Some reports in Africa would say that that's TB up close to 100% of the time. I'm talking about large pericardial effusions in HIV-positive patients. If they're HIV-negative, it's probably still a 50% chance of being TB. The problem is it's very hard to diagnose TB, to see the AFB, to see the TB in front of you in these patients. And I'm not talking about small pericardial effusions. So what do? We do a pericardiocentesis. The surgeons typically do them. And we rule out a malignancy because we have a pathologist. And since we have a pathologist, I think that's the right thing to do. And then we treat for TB. We're not going to see AFB. We're not going to get the firm diagnosis off of that fluid. We're going to have to treat based on what we know is likely. If you didn't have a pathologist and didn't have any other evidence of malignancy, solely with a large pericardial effusion in an HIV-positive patient, I would treat that as TB. This is a chest x-ray from a patient with TB pericarditis. You see the huge globular heart. So we see this not infrequently. Things are a little different at Bingo because we just got a gene expert machine, which is a PCR machine for TB. This incredible help from some people in a town nearby that are trying to do some study, trying to do some studies on this in places like our hospital, and they were provided this, and the testing is free of charge. And this has been a big help to us. But it doesn't solve all of our problems for TB pericarditis because even still, that fluid is only going to be positive 50% of the time, even with PCR. So you're still going to have negative tests, even with PCR, looking for small pieces of TB. And you're still going to say, well, this patient probably still has TB. Hepatitis B, very common in sub-Saharan Africa. It's a cause of many issues, as you guys know, cirrhosis, portal hypertension, esophageal varices, hepatocellular carcinoma. We see it in young people. Treating is very difficult. Serologic testing is needed. Viral load testing would be good. You need to have access to the drugs, which can be expensive. But we are able to treat one of the side effects at Bingo, esophageal variceal banding. We're able to do that in our endoscopy room. So this is an example of some of the advanced endoscopic techniques that we're able to do in our endoscopy room and what we're able to teach our residents as well. So this is me doing a banding of a patient with esophageal varices, and then you see one of our residents looking on. This is Dr. Camden. He has since learned how to do EGDs, and he actually does most of the endoscopy at Bingo and does it very well, and he can even do esophageal variceal banding. So something, one of our residents has graduated and learned this skill and now applying it. Caustic ingestions. This is more of a pediatric topic, but I see it a lot because of the endoscopy that I do. Accidental ingestions are common in children. In Cameroon, maybe in other areas, it's usually an alkaline liquid. And unfortunately, it's an ingredient used to make soap. And people keep it in old Coke bottles, and unfortunately, they keep it on the ground. Children get it, and they can drink it, and causes a very severe esophageal injury. The only way to treat this is to do frequent and difficult dilations of the esophagus. Replacing the esophagus is a huge surgical problem that has its own problem. One time it was done at Bingo, and it was successful, but it is very, very difficult. So maintaining the lumen is the best option. This is a patient that had a very severe episode. You see a G-tube is in place, and we have an orange small tube wrapped around that extends up through the nose, and then we tape it to the side of the face to maintain the lumen of the esophagus in between dilations. If you guys want to know more about any of this stuff, I'm happy to talk afterwards, but we'll keep moving. Last thing I want to say, pathology. I can't leave here without making a small plug for pathology. We are dependent on pathology every day at Bingo, and it's changed what we're able to do, the diagnosis we're able to make. We use ultrasound and we use needles to get samples of masses in the abdomen, other places, and our pathologist is able to give us diagnoses we would have no chance of making otherwise. And that's allowed us to treat a lot of cancers we wouldn't otherwise be able to treat. And that's often with our PACS program. But we give protocol-driven chemotherapy alongside of some of the surgeries that they're able to offer. And so if you're a pathologist or maybe a hematologist-oncologist and thinking about, is there a place for me to practice what I know in the mission field, there is. This is me doing an ultrasound. You see one of our residents has got his gloves on. He's actually about to do the procedure. I was just checking the mass in the liver to see where he was going to stick it. So I'm out of time, but I do want to take any questions that you guys may have. I think during the break would be best. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. We'll go ahead and take about a 15-minute break, and we'll restart promptly at 10 minutes of 11. Thank you.